Speaking from the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara. In the spring of 1968, the center sponsored an international conference seeking to explore ways in which dialogue might replace the Cold War confrontation between Eastern and Western Europe. One participant was Herbert Marcuse, professor of philosophy at the University of California at San Diego and author of Eros and Civilization, One-Dimensional Man, and Reason and Revolution. Between sessions of our conference, Professor Marcuse talked informally with Harvey Wheeler, political scientist and center fellow. Professor Marcuse, who enjoys a great following among the new left, is often referred to as one of the most influential thinkers in a relatively recent movement that is sometimes called Marxist humanism. Mr. Wheeler began the conversation by asking what the term means.
The first thing that I'd like to find out about is what, in brief, Marxist humanism means. I'd like to know how, in the first place, it differs from other kinds of Marxism, and then, of course, how it differs from other kinds of humanism.
Well, you may know that I am not very happy about the term Marxist humanism. To me, it is somehow redundant, and I very much disagree with the widespread tendencies to read only the early writings of Marx and to find the humanism only there, completely disregarding the fact that what Marx's humanism really is, that is in Das Kapital and in the later writings of Marx, namely to put it as simply as possible, the building of a world without the domination of man by man and without the exploitation of man by man. And in as much as this new world would require a completely different society with completely different institutions and completely different human relationships, Marx's humanism is at the same time the theory and the strategy of revolution.
I see now, and I guess coming into this element in Marx would be the discussion of alienation and the elimination of alienation, which is part of what you mentioned about exploitation. Now, I'm familiar with three other kinds of humanism. There are probably thousands of them, but the three prominent ones are what we sometimes call Renaissance humanism, and then there is a tradition that has come to be known as Christian humanism, and more recently, of course, we've been learning about existentialist humanism. So I wonder if you would mind distinguishing in some way those other humanisms, if they can be distinguished,
yes,
from what you have in mind.
As to the first two, I would say that Marxist humanism is different because by it is meant a life, a form of life, of existence, in which men can determine their own way of living, determine their own needs, determine their own way of satisfying their needs, and of developing their needs, and in this sense, to exist as free human beings. On this sense, which distinguishes it very definitely and ultimately from Christianity.
Christian humanism. Not necessarily from Renaissance.
Well, Renaissance humanism was a very confined humanism, confined to an intellectual elite, because the vast majority of the population certainly did have neither had the means nor the time to developing what is called their personality. They had to engage in the dirty work, and only a very small elite actually was capable of achieving this humanist idea.
So you would in a sense say that what is shared by Marxist and Renaissance humanism is in Marxist humanism thoroughly democratized.
Yes, thoroughly democratized.
And now, as we all know, Sartre wrote this book, Existentialism is a Humanism, and is also then a Marxist, and I guess it follows as a Marxist humanism. But is there some distinction in your mind between Marxist humanism as you know it and have written about it, and existentialist variety?
There's a considerable distinction. In the first place, I would like to say I don't think it is fair to refer today to Sartre existentialism is a humanism, because he has explicitly and implicitly indicated that he no longer holds his position and has politically and theoretically gone far beyond.
Well, in that case, we have to refer to the life that this doctrine has of its own.
That's right.
Without regard to this.
It has been said in connection with existentialism, and I agree that the freedom of man, which existentialism at that stage defined, is a dreadful thing. Yeah, this is no more or no less than to be free than to do what is necessary. And for example, and that is in my view one of the most objectionable concepts in Sartre, he has maintained that man can be free even in a concentration camp, because he always retains the liberty to reject his faith by protesting and being shot. Now I think this is a caricature on the idea of human freedom, and he himself, Sartre himself, has gone far beyond.
Now, as you know certainly, you've become celebrated in a somewhat unlikely place. Time and Life.
Yes.
Time Magazine.
I'm very much worried.
And this is not to disturb anyone. But
time, well, you see, if I may say that, it is at the same time a beautiful verification of my philosophy, that in this society everything can be co-opted and everything can be digested.
You become part of the establishment.
That's right. I can become part of the establishment itself.
Time Magazine has referred to you as the prophet of Europe's New Left. And of course, we know today that Europe's New Left is in revolt. Now, personally, I'd like to ask you to explain a little bit what is new about Europe's New Left, and what it is, and then secondly, how it is different from the American New Left.
But to the first point, which is common to the American New Left, they do no longer adhere to the old ideologies, including Marxian ideologies, where these ideologies are obviously denied by the parents. There's no longer this exclusive focusing, for example, that is on the working classes, so, as the only agent of change. And there is, and that seems to me most important, the conviction, the feeling, the deep, profound feeling, that it is a socialist society that essentially from the established societies, no matter how good they may be, it isn't worth fighting.
Now, is this a criticism against the Eastern collective
that contains a lot of criticism of the Eastern socialist society, which the New Left, especially in Europe, criticizes that this is still mainly replacing one form of control and one form of domination by another.
And here we get into discussions of bureaucratic power, the bureaucratic state.
At the same time, however, they do believe, and I share this belief, that the socialist societies of the East still have the potential and the possibility to develop into a genuine.
They don't have the original sin of property relationship
and law, right.
And this gives them the possibility of ultimate freedom. Now, you mentioned that they have abandoned a certain element of traditional Marxist class analysis. Now, what
because it was abandoned in reality?
Because life passed by. Now, what is, and this is a serious question for Marxism in general today, what is one to look forward to as the agent of revolutionary change if the working class is not any longer to be regarded as an agency of revolution?
I have been bothered about this question for a long time, and I'm afraid I cannot give you a satisfactory answer. The only thing I can say is that it seems to me wrong to go around looking for the agents of historical change. The agents of change probably will come up and will become identifiable only in the process of change itself. but I cannot simply become a fetus or withdraw by saying there are no people who can identify as a
fetus. Now,
our world probably creates, or has to create ancient.
Well, now let's follow that just a little bit further. Because if one actually abandons the dialectical mechanism producing a revolutionary class, one has abandoned a great deal of Marxist theory in that step.
That's certainly true.
Now, what would you make of the maneuver that is sometimes announced, namely that the agency of revolution is no longer to be looked for from inside the nation state, but rather on a world level in which what we loosely call the third world becomes the external proletariat and is in effect the working class in Marxist terms of the entire West, the industrial combine, as if it were a class, with the dynamics of the Marxist revolution will work itself out that way, the third world takes the role in the world at large that the working class was said to take inside the nation.
I go a long way with this conception, and even more, I think it is a genuine dialectical development of the Marxists. Corporate capitalism today is a global system, and what may appear first as external proletariat is actually an internal proletariat
in terms of what?
In terms of the world, in terms of the global interest and the global power of capitalism. So very definitely these third world forces, the historical era of the Marxian proletariat, are in this sense in the dominion of corporate capitalism.
Now this makes an interesting tie between, let us say, the movement of the African peoples and their struggle for independence and freedom, and on the other hand, the struggle of the technically minorities within South America, namely the Negroes. In terms of the world struggle, they cease to become a minority. And the argument we always make against the Negro Revolution is, well, how can a minority pull off a revolution? But in terms of the analysis that we've been following now, they cease to become a minority, and they become a very potentially effective vanguard of the revolutionary movement.
On the other hand, I don't think we can overlook that at this stage, the effective link between the black people in this country and in Africa are practically
non-existent. Spiritual. Martin Luther King, that this link is spiritually simple.
Yes.
And
what is for the time being only a matter of the future.
Now, let's come back to the new left, because I wanted to get some feeling for what marks the difference there are between the European new left and the American new left. One of these marks I would take it is that while the American new left is not necessarily Marxist in foundation, one branch of this, but not all branches, the new European new left is apparently a developing or evolutionary Marxist orientation.
Neo-Marxist.
And are there any other differences that you think? For example, the American New Left is very, very emotionally involved in the struggle for participatory democracy. And this feeling for community, the word community, building new communities that are essentially democratic and unalienated. Is there any of this strain in the European New Left?
There is, but in a very different way, because the European New Left works and operates in a very different context. It operates in the context of societies where a large part of the labor movement is still at least potentially radical, Marxist, and political, which is not the case in the United States. And therefore, this ally of that right. And so in Europe, this participatory democracy can assume much more concrete and real forms. For example, the participation of labor in management, what they call co-gestion, auto-gestion, That is a strategy of labor as advocated by Andre Gorz, for example, and in Yugoslavia very strongly. But that in this country wouldn't make any sense. None whatsoever, because the participation of labor and management would mean in no way any radical political change to the better.
Now, in the papers today, of course, we're speaking at a time that's just about the end of April. The papers today are full of the riots that have occurred and the demonstrations that have occurred in West Germany over the incident that involved one of your disciples. A very brilliant man, I understand.
I wonder if you'd say a little bit about him, why he is so significant.
He appears to have almost a prophetic role.
He appears to almost attract worship.
And then also something about the Springer Press
and why
the feeling against it is so intense among the students.
Well, I met this young man named Rudi Dutschke.
Rudi Dutschke.
Rudi Dutschke. I met Rudi only, I think, about a year ago in Berlin. And I was immediately taken by him and taken to him. He is a highly intelligent, honest, highly and active.
She married an American girl.
He married an American girl, yes, a Chicago girl. He is, in my view, one of the great hopes of all those who will for a better society. And as I said to the German president when they came to the day after the Valentine, the great hope of all those who work for a better society and for the abolition of the laws of the established. The man who is equally intelligent in questions of theory and of practice, and by the way he organized demonstrations, all these forms of organization, and so on, is absolutely amazing. I think that is all I can say about him.
You're going to say something about the Springer Press and
the Springer Press
feeling is so high.
You know that the Springer concern had a monopoly of, I think, about 70% of the decisive public opinion making newspapers and magazines in Germany. And
these are the national press.
And
there are many local presses, but this paper is international.
National audience, that's right. And he is fully supporting the war in Vietnam. His papers have led for more than a year vicious campaign against the student opposition. They are in favor of all the reactionary policies in West Germany and Berlin. And their language was such that the attempted assassination of Rudi Dutschke to me didn't come to surprising enough.
You wouldn't go so far as to say that there's any incitement.
No, you have to be careful in saying that. Look at the language of the papers, what has it been doing all these years, and then look at
the Springer Press, however, is not strictly speaking neo-Nazi, is it? Or would you say that it has some overtones of the neo-Nazi?
If you identify Nazis with anti-Semitism, no.
He's not anti-Semitic.
Certainly not, on the contrary. Careful to give large amounts of money to Israel and to Brandeis University.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Neo-Nazi in this sense, no. But in the way in which I described it, the exponent of all the repressive and aggressive politicians.
So that he is, in classical Marxist term, an apology for imperialism and colonialism and neocolonialism, I take it.
I understand.
And this helps explain the animus of the students. I take it then, in addition to that, he represents a subtle new expression of the establishment of the power elite that makes him
a highly concentrated
of a new sophisticated type. So his influence is somewhat new for the continental European mind to cope with. We've been accustomed to your friends at Time Magazine exercising this kind of influence for a long time, so we take it perhaps a little bit too easily in our stride. But this is
in Germany, I think this is something
new. Germany. Yeah. That is part of the counts for the violence of the reaction.
Yeah.
Now, there's one other problem that I'm curious about, and I know that you're
very
much
aware of
and interested in. And we know really very little about this, but we're told that there is an extremely exciting, very vital Christian Marxist dialogue taking place in Europe, and indeed spreading to America, as witness to the conference we're having here, the conference that was held last year at the University of Notre Dame, and these conferences between Christians and Marxists are spreading like wildfire. In fact, I'm afraid it's getting a little modish.
You know, we talked about that this morning. I'm afraid of that in this dialogue when ends by glossing over the real difference.
I'd like to ask you what you make of the Christian Marxist dialogue.
What is it?
And what is involved? Are both sides making fundamental compromises or not?
Well, that's just the point. We don't know yet. I mean, don't misunderstand me. I would definitely say it is better to have these dialogues than not to have. But on the other hand, I repeat, there is a danger of covering up or glossing over the real and substantial differences between Christianity and Marxism.
Could you put your finger on what you think the most difficult?
Yes. For example, I can hardly imagine any Christianity without the transcendent element, without the commitment to Christ as the Messiah, and the faith, the belief in a world hereafter. And this is absolutely contrary to Marxism, which believes that the human condition can and should be improved by man's own power, and that any promise of a world hereafter can only serve to prolong or absolve the actual suffering of man.
Now, first, with regard to the transcendence,
yes,
there is, I guess, a possibility of suggesting that Herbert Marcuse in Reason and Revolution had in some sense a doctrine of transcendence.
Yes, you are quite right. The only difference being that the transcendence I was talking of there is an empirical historical transcendence to a different form of society, where the Christian transcendence is a transcendence out of this world to another one.
Alright, now, the second question along that line is there not this allegedly new breed of Christian theologian that develops or reduces or transforms Christianity into something like the transcendence and the doctrine that you yourself have developed?
Yes, but then I'm at a loss to say in what sense they are still Christian.
So if they join you, that means that they're simply joining it.
Yes.
All right, that's a good point. But the fact does remain, does it not, that the most exciting developments in Christian theology are developments along this line. And it is among the people who are making these theological developments that the Christian Marxist dialogue is taking place most actively and most fruitfully.
Yes, that is true. However, I would say that the really great change in Christianity is rather represented by those Christians and others who actually join, for example, the guerrillas in Latin America and fight with them. I mean, those are real Christians. And
talking about the Basques and we're putting their doctrines on the firing line rather than in the seminar. I think that's a good point. Now, the question that is puzzling me with regard to the Christian Marxist dialogue is What difference does it make?
Let's put it another way.
How many Christians are there left in the world, anyway, and where is Christianity going? Why would Marxists want to engage in it?
That depends on your definition of Christian and Christianity. I mean, if you take, for example, Kierkegaard's definition, I think very few Christians will be left here on earth. And the vast majority is not considered.
See, what I'm trying to get at, perhaps a little facetiously, is how significant is it, even if it exists, the Christian Marxist dialogue? Does that mean anything?
It is significant in the sense that it brings us together with our counterparts in the East. That there's a real exchange of ideas. And that out of this exchange of ideas, perhaps we are finding means and ways of trying to prevent or delay the outbreak of nuclear war, intensification of hostile coexistence, or whatever it is. But I don't think we should overrate the actual importance of that.
Now, one of the most active leaders in the Christian Marxist dialogue is, of course, Roger Garraudy of France. And Garraudy is interesting for many reasons, but one of them is that he has seized upon Teilhard de Chardin as a bridge between Christians and Marxists. And Teilhard de Chardin was, of course, a priest who was kind of a biologist and a kind of a theorist of evolution and a kind of a theologian. And some people say he wasn't any good at any one of these, but he wrote brilliant books and very exciting books, very exciting ideas. So what I'd like to know is, do you feel that Garraudy has a sound intuition here, and what is your own feeling about the work of Teilhard?
Well, all I can say is I have read a little Teilhard de Chardin, and I couldn't find out by any stretch of the imagination why he is so important in this interesting Marxist dialogue, why he is so important for Marx. It seemed to me along this line, I want to get as much more a transformation of Marxism into a semi-Christian doctrine than a radicalization of Christianity.
I see. So you feel that Garraudy has a somewhat reactionary
if you press me, I might be willing to.
Okay. Well, I must say, I thank you very much for
your very welcome,
interesting and informative discussion.
You have been listening to an informal conversation recorded at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara during a conference on East-West Dialogue. Harvey Wheeler, a fellow at the Center, talked with Herbert Marcuse of the University of California at San Diego. Parts of the conversation were later published in the July issue of The Center magazine under the title Varieties of Humanism. If you would like to receive a copy of that issue, write Box 4068, Santa Barbara. That address again, Box 4068, Santa Barbara. This is Alec Hoffman speaking from the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara.